I should say that when Professor Blackshear advocates a golden rule ethic rather than a lifeboat ethic, he's not doing this simply because SOBs like me might kick him out of the lifeboat. Indeed, if you are confined to living in a lifeboat for a long period of time, you want to have somebody who can patch the holes and maintain the cracks. And Perry is such an innovative engineer that anybody in the lifeboat would love to invite him aboard to keep the water out. Professor Blackshear has laid out, really, from a worldwide picture, what kind of constraints we are living under in the Twin City metropolitan area as you begin to address the question of the environment and energy problems in the year 2000. There are two components of this problem that I'd like to address myself to a little bit this afternoon. The first has to do with the way in which we organize for a technological response to the kinds of problems that Professor Blackshear has raised. At the very end of his talk, he briefly raised the prospect of using agricultural waste for energy in the state of Minnesota. This just doesn't happen automatically. There's a technology which is necessary to make that possible. And one of the questions that is raised, how do we develop that technology? And from an even a little bit more sophisticated point of view, how do we decide whether to put resources into developing that technology or choose some alternative that might even, for the metropolitan area, for the state, for the nation, and the world, be even more desirable? Now, in looking at the problem of the development of technology in response to the kinds of problems that Professor Blackshear have raised, we must recognize that there are essentially two theories that are current. One is a theory which argues that science and technology is essentially exogenous to any meaningful set of social or human concerns. It's a picture of science developing in the laboratory of the disinterested, if not mad, scientist and engineer who is pursuing his own interests, his own motivations, and out of the laboratory comes scientific inventions, which are then used by society. And society is more or less at the mercy of what happens to be the motivations and interests of that small group of elite who are developing them. A second theory argues that technological innovation is really an endogamous force in society. That is, there are various mechanisms which induce technological inventions in certain areas in response to the definition of certain kinds of social and human problems. Now, I am an advocate of this former view. And what I'd like to do is to talk a little bit now about something which is terribly remote from Metro 2000 or the Twin City metropolitan area. But I want to try to give you an idea of the way in which, looked at historically, these technology inducement mechanisms have operated. And from this brief review of history, we can, I think, begin to draw some lessons that are really quite appropriate to the problem of the Twin City metropolitan area over the next 25 years. I want to draw my remarks on a study which was done by Hayami and Rutan on Japanese and American agricultural development from 1880 to 1950. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about this comparative study. The first is that over that period, Japanese and American agriculture increased in productivity by almost exactly the same amount. It averaged about 1.5% per decade over that entire period. And if you compound that, it can be a rather sizable increase. While they were alike in this regard, they were very different in the way in which that productivity increase is measured. Over that time period in the United States, the increase in productivity was almost entirely an increase in output per man hour. And so if you want to look at how agricultural production, how agricultural productivity increased, you look at it as an increase in the effectiveness and efficiency of the manpower input. And output per acre remained almost constant over that period of time. In Japan, by contrast, output per man hour over that period of time remained almost the same, and output per acre went up significantly. Now, what was the reason for this rather remarkable increase in agricultural productivity? In the United States, it came about by and large because of the invention of labor-saving machinery. The harvester, the tractor, the thrasher, the combine. And essentially what it made possible was for one man to farm more acres. In Japan, the increase in output per acre came about primarily because of the invention of a land substitute technology. New crop varieties, new fertilizers, pesticides, which were really a replacement for land and not a replacement for manpower. Now, why is it that in the United States a labor-saving technology developed, and in Japan a land-saving technology developed, and what was the institutional context in which these developments occurred? Well, the relatively scarce factor of production in American agriculture was manpower. From 1880 to 1950, there was a lot of acres around that could be exploited. What was short was manpower, relatively. In Japan, the opposite was true. Terribly constrained on the land side, but a rapidly growing population. So, if you were trying to adjust to this pattern of scarce resources in agricultural production in the two countries, this is what you would do if you were some grand designer who was trying to lay it out. We find something else very interesting. We find that in the United States, this labor-saving technology was by and large invented in the private sector. And in Japan, the biological and chemical technology was by and large invented in the public sector, in the Japanese equivalent of American agricultural research stations. Now, in the period since 1950, the patterns of increases in agricultural productivity in these two countries have begun to look alike. There has been, since 1950 in the United States, a very significant increase in output per acre, and this increase has come by and large because of the development of chemical and biological technologies. New crop varieties, fertilizers, pesticides, so on and so forth. Japan, there has been a considerable increase in the output per man hour, and it's come about by and large because of the invention of a labor-saving machinery. Now, if we look at this pattern of invention in the two countries from 1950 to the present time, something very astounding emerges. Although these are very different economies, particularly in their agricultural sector, in the United States, this biological and chemical technology that was necessary for an increase in output per acre was also by and large invented in the public sector. And in Japan, the labor-saving machinery that was necessary for their increase in output per man hour was by and large invented in the public sector. What is there about this technology inducement process, which means that in two countries so different as the United States and Japan, the labor-saving technology in both societies was developed in the private sector and the biological and chemical technology in the public sector? Well, again, Hayami and Rutan provide some answers to this. They argue that by and large, a labor-saving technology in agriculture is patentable. The man who invents it can patent it. The firm that owns the patent and develops it then can then capture a sizable proportion of the profit which is generated by that invention. By and large, with a couple of exceptions, but by and large, a biological and chemical technology is not patentable. A firm which put a lot of R&D into the development of that could not capture the benefits because, by and large, there is no way of patenting the results. If you develop a new variety of wheat, for example, A farmer grows it one year, he can then sell that seed the next year. And it could spread very rapidly. A crucial invention in the development of increased production in corn was, of course, the development of the hybrid. The important invention there was the technology for how you do it. And once you develop that, you can't patent it. It can be spread very easily. Now, we pretty much understand the operation of a mechanism that makes the private sector responsive to societal needs. And it operates, by and large, through a version of the price mechanism in which there are entrepreneurs, people that are investing in R&D, who make projections on essentially a futures market and the factors of production. They're looking off into the future and looking at the relative price of manpower, of land, and of capital, and are adjusting their inventions to take advantage of that future pattern of relative scarcities. And the firms that are successful in doing this are, by and large, the firms that prosper. They're the firms that have the capital that can invest in this again and again. How does it operate in the public sector? In the public sector, it operates in a manner which has some parallels to this. In both Japan and the United States, the decentralized organization of agricultural colleges and experiment stations, with very close ties to their user group, was awfully crucial. Now, it turns out that this biological and chemical technology is very area-specific. A crop that will grow in one part of Japan and the United States doesn't grow very well in another part. There has to be something invented for that part. And by and large, and simply what happened was that you'd have an agricultural experiment station which would develop a crop variety, let's say, that was very effective in one small region. And the farmers that used that began to increase their returns quite effectively. Farmers in a neighboring region that couldn't use that same variety began to suffer relatively, and they would go to their agricultural experiment station or local agricultural college and begin to generate pressures for the development of something which would be comparable. Now, how does this all relate to the problem of Metro 2000 and the environmental and energy crisis? In a couple of ways. I think we, first of all, should recognize that in the technological response which is necessary to make will partly be generated in the private sector. Although I think if Perry and I talk together in some detail about this, you could begin to point out that many of the kinds of inventions which would be necessary to use Minnesota agricultural waste to adopt solar energy, for example, are not patentable. They're sort of within the state of the art at the present time. And there has to be some developments and refinements. Or there are certain problems of the manufacturing of these, which would make private firm capturing of the benefits or some portion of the benefits relatively difficult. That means that there is going to have to be some institutional development in the public sector that can respond to these kinds of needs. We don't have it at the present time. And we have very few of any people in the state who are thinking about what you would do to develop it. Point number two. Although the environmental crisis does have this worldwide dimension that Professor Blacksher talked about, the adaptation to that crisis, in many regards, is very regionally specific. For example, if you look at the problem of space heating in the United States, it's considerably different in Minnesota than it is in Arizona. The way in which you would develop the technology for solar energy might differ greatly depending upon the particular climatological region of the country that you're in, which would suggest that there has to be some way of responding to this international crisis in a way which is locally specific and can be adjusted to local concerns. This is something which we have done not only in the Twin City metropolitan area, but I think in the country at large, very badly. Suggest when you go home tonight, you read a copy of the Minneapolis Star. There's a front page story which talks about the catalytic converter on automobiles. The story says essentially that the catalytic converter converter is making the pollution problem in Minneapolis worse. Why? Turns out the catalytic converter doesn't work when it's cold, when the engine is cold. The major problem of carbon monoxide pollution in downtown Minneapolis happens to be at the evening rush hour when everybody is starting their cold car at the same time. It takes 10 or 15 minutes to warm that converter up enough so it works. The engines with a catalytic converter are actually dirtier than the engines were before. So you are dumping more pollution into the atmosphere in Minneapolis than you were before the device. Now, I would be willing to argue that it is very difficult to conceive of a solution to automobile pollution which is nationwide. The same thing you need in Mandan, North Dakota, is what you need in Los Angeles, what you need in Minneapolis. And I think that we had better start thinking about how we develop the institutions that can adjust to this locally necessary feature of the environmental crisis. Now, a third point. It is not simply the problem of providing great financial subsidies to public institutions like Professor Blackshear's research laboratories. One of the crucial questions that enters in the consideration of this technological response to the environmental crisis is what the economists would refer to as the opportunity costs. By the opportunity costs, we mean, what is the cost of spending X number of dollars in this area in terms of all the other areas that we can't then spend that money in? This kind of a question. If a catalytic converter, in terms of initial costs and replacement costs, runs about $400 per automobile, and you produce 10 million automobiles a year, you're spending $4 billion. That's $4 billion you can't spend on something else. Would there be a better way to spend it? Now, you're not going to solve that problem by having some group of high-powered planners sitting back and thinking about it. You're going to solve it by designing the kind of institutional structure which is sensitive to that kind of concern. And I would submit to you that not only in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area, but also nationally, this nation in regard to the environmental energy crisis has not been sensitive to the regional differences, nor has it been sensitive to the design of some kind of decision mechanism that can cope with an assessment of the opportunity costs. Fourth point, to the degree that the development of the kind of technology which is necessary to respond to the kinds of problems that Professor Blackshear raised occurs in the private sector, I think you will tend to see a bias in the direction of a technology which capitalizes on economies of scale. And that is, you'll see a bias in the direction of very large-scale technologies that have great initial capital requirements, are large-scale installations, oftentimes require, relative to others, considerable concentrated manpower. In talking about this particular problem, I think it's necessary to recognize that not only should I make the argument that there are ways in which you can make technology responsive to social needs if you have the right institutional structure, but that the kind of technology which emerges also is a very important determinant of your social institutions and your social arrangements. I personally think there are some problems of the continuing elaboration of a technology which capitalizes on great economies of scale. There are a number of effects of this. One of the effects of this is that it tends to greatly increase the interdependencies among various social and geographical components of the country. You can see this if you just look at the problem, say, of running an agricultural plant in the state of Minnesota based very heavily on petroleum. A problem of a war in the Middle East, and agricultural production in Minnesota is very badly affected. Because of the enormous economies of scale which have been associated and capitalized in the development of our petroleum industry. For reasons I don't have time to go into, I'd like to argue that in the private sector there is a bias, for very good reasons, in the development of that kind of technology. The kind of things that Professor Blackshear and I have been thinking about and working on a little bit, for example, the utilization of agricultural waste in Minnesota, would try to emphasize a small-scale technology, which would greatly reduce the interdependencies which exist and tend to make certain regions far more autonomous, independent from other kinds of other regions as they begin to meet the energy and environmental problems that they face. I think, again, that the emphasis in this direction is something which is going to have to occur, by and large, in the innovative activities within the public sector. How you develop within the public sector the institutions that make this technology responsive to the preferences of the people in the community is something I don't know. But it's something we better learn something about in the next 10 or 15 years if we want a desirable Metro 2000. Okay, the second general point I want to talk about is the problem of what might be some institutional developments in the country, particularly in the Twin City metropolitan area, which are relevant to the problem of the environmental and energy crisis and addresses itself a little bit to one of the subtitles on your topic, Living in a Period of Declining Affluence. The book published several years ago by an economist by the name of William Niskanen called Representative Government and Bureaucracy. And he was concerned here with the way in which, in the American system of government generally, decisions are made for the allocation of resources for the production of goods and services in the public sector. And as economists are quite prone to do, he likes to simplify the problem a great deal to get an analytic handle on it. And he talks about the problems in terms of two stereotypical institutions. First of all is what he calls a bureaucracy. And the bureaucracy can be just about anything you want it to be that is a bureaucracy. It could be a police department, it could be HEW in Washington, it could be the State Department of Agriculture, any government organization which is headed by a person we could call a bureaucrat. And the other institution he talks about is what he refers to as the review committee. The review committee is a democratically elected group. It could be the American Congress, it could be a committee of Congress, it could be the Minneapolis City Council, it could be the state legislature. And his model fits any of those circumstances. Now, Niskanen argues that a bureaucrat, and he's now sort of taking the bureaucrat as the head of these various agencies, is a little bit like a private entrepreneur. Private entrepreneur, as all economists know, is out to maximize his profit. For the bureaucrat, there's no real measure of profit. So the bureaucrat is out to maximize his budget. Now, he is reviewed by this review committee. And the review committee, as it gets collected, is not only allocating money to one bureaucrat, but to all the bureaucrats under its jurisdiction. So the bureaucrats are sort of competing with one another, as each one is trying to maximize his budget. Now, Niskanen draws attention to a potential danger in this, and I think it is particularly a danger if you begin to look at a society living under conditions of declining affluence. Niskanen argues that there is a tendency in the direction of this review committee, and again, we look at this stereotypically as a committee of Congress, although it could also be, in the future, a committee of the Minneapolis City Council or a committee of the St. Paul City Council or a committee of the Metropolitan Council. There's a tendency for these review committees to be composed of the representatives of two groups in the society. One group is what he calls the suppliers of the factor inputs to the production of the goods or service under the direction of this bureaucrat. In other words, a bureaucrat is producing goods or service. He may be producing defense, in which case he has to have tanks, and the factor supplier is a defense manufacturer. If the bureaucrat is in charge of a school system, he needs to have teachers. The teachers are providing a factor input. And so these review committees tend to be made up, out of proportion to the rest of the population, of the representative of the factor suppliers. And secondly, they tend to be made up increasingly of representatives of what he calls the high beneficiary consumer groups. If you wanted to get some idea of what kinds of things that happen if growth rates go, if increases in GNP go to zero or actually go negative over a long period of time, I think you can take a look at the United Kingdom over the past 15 or 20 years. That's the kind of problem they faced. Rarely have they been in a situation where their GNP increase has been over 1%. And in many years, it has actually been negative, particularly if measured in terms of the value of the pound on the international market. What happens over this period of time? One of the things that happens that I think we must be concerned with is that you tend to have a much greater degree of cohesive organization in all of the various productive groups within society that have organized to protect their particular share of the pie. And the arguments are made that in a period of very rapid inflation, in a period of very little, if any, increase in GNP, each group must, at a minimum, protect its previous level of a standard of living. If inflation was 15%, we must have at least a 15% increase in income. Or on a producer side, a firm must have a price increase that would be at least comparable to that. Now, if your production is falling off and going negative, and you have less to pass out this year than last year, then everybody can't at least stay even. And who stays even or does better? The groups that, one, are the best organized, and two, are in the strongest position to hold society up for ransom. In England, it happened to be very powerfully the coal miners. He said, we'll go on strike, and we're going to put the nation on a three-day work week. And you can only last on a three-day work week for 6 weeks. And then you close down. Now, what do you do in the face of that? What do you do in the face of the organization of society in which 15, 20, or 25 major sectors of society are organized the same way and can all hold the society up for ransom? How do you cope with it? Let me tell you, those that are not in a position to get into such a group hurt and hurt terribly. Now, if we begin to look at this in terms of the other issues that I raised, this relates to this problem of technologies of scale that I talked, or economies of scale that I talked about. It relates to problems of the development of, say, the institutional structure and the technological structure for transportation. When deciding, for example, in response partially to the energy crisis and the environmental crisis, of a mass transit system for the Twin City metropolitan area, notice that if you put in some automated great mass transit system with billions and billions of dollars of investment, that there are at least two groups, the management of that and the labor in that, that can make enormous demands on the public institutions of the society if they want to hold it up for ransom. That kind of institutional structure is very different than a kind of institutional structure that could exist in some cities where you might have 5 or 6 or 7 bus companies operating, each one by law independent. Very different in terms of its social implication And yet I would argue that in this metropolitan area and most other metropolitan areas, in the kinds of technological decisions that are made in relation to such things as transit, that set of concerns is by and large ignored. But if we are living in a period of declining affluence, those kind of problems are going to become increasingly significant, and I think must be addressed by the responsible citizenry. I'd like to close by taking a very long-range historical perspective on the problem of Metro 2000. And I think it's important for you, through this series of lectures this fall, to take something of this longer view. It starts by asking the very fundamental question, why do we have cities in the first place? Or why do we have metropolitan areas? Well, if we look at this back over 5,000 or 6,000 years of human history, we find a couple of things. By and large, on the production side, cities have developed because of economies of scale and economies of density that were associated with those living patterns. The first of these were probably economies of scale and defense. If you had to defend a population of 10,000 people, it was much easier to put them together, build a wall around the city, than it was to have 10,000 people spread out over 10,000 acres. And if you look at the early cities of the world, almost all of them had a wall around them. Almost all of them were built partially for defense and fortification reasons. If you look at the technology of war of the 20th century, there is no economy of scale in a city. In fact, if you were going to defend yourself against a hydrogen bomb, the last thing in the world you want is 8 million people living on 200 square miles. Okay? There's another economy of scale that was involved. This was an economy of scale in relationship to commerce. It reflected best in the development of port cities. If there's going to be some kind of international or interregional trade, as soon as you get to a technology which involves some kind of ship, some kind of transport of this particular kind, it becomes important to concentrate the docks together rather than having it spread all over the map. This leads to the development of cities. There's also economies associated with the workforce. We have to have them living closely together before the advent of modern transportation. Third, and actually most significant, although most ignored by somebody who's sort of looking at this casually, the city emerged in human history because of certain economies in the production of services, not of goods. What did the pre-industrial city do? There was not very much produced in the pre-industrial city in relationship to what was produced in the countryside, in goods. The city, by and large, produced administrative services. It produced government for itself and for the hinterland. It produced religious administrative services, the seat of the churches, and of church hierarchies. It was not really until the Industrial Revolution that the city became a place of goods production. And that is only within the past couple of hundred years, out of 5,000 years. A fourth thing we should recognize about the city, and again something which is typically ignored, is historically probably the city was a far more important place, far more important as a place of consumption than it was a place of production. It was a place to go to the theater, it was a place to go to the circus, it was a place to go to be entertained. And you can look all the way back from Roman and Greek cities up into modern cities and find that there is a kind of service which can apparently only be generated in a city and only be consumed in a city. We see them today in theaters and art galleries and operas and symphonies and so on and so forth. And historically, before the advent of the Industrial Revolution, this is probably the most important function of the city. Try to chase a place for generating that set of consumer services to which a certain relatively well-off segment of the population could benefit from. I think it's important to say, is the industrial city an aberration? Does it happen to reflect a particular minuscule period in the history of mankind, which led to the city primarily as a place for production? And as we look to Metro 2000 and beyond, should we concern ourselves with the development of a metropolitan area which is not primarily oriented to the production of things, as most cities that we know about are, but is primarily oriented to the production of services and of consumer services for a wide, wide hinterland? If that indeed is part of the pattern of the end of the next 25 years and the beginning of the 21st century, then we're probably talking about an organization, particularly a social organization, of the Twin City metropolitan area, which is very different than has been known in any city in the United States during its history. Thank you.